see if somebody's coming in. All right, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Aaron Vandenbroek, and I represent the appellant Calvin Butcher in this appeal. May I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal? To begin, Your Honor, a negative element, just like any other element, is one that the Commonwealth has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. In the present case, the Commonwealth did not meet this burden with regard to the element of whether or not the appellant made the necessary report of his information to any of the parties that were listed in the statute. The Court of Appeals reasoned below that because there was essentially no evidence regarding whether the report was made, that means that the burden had shifted to the appellant and that the appellant thus had the duty of proving that the report was made. However, this abrogates the Commonwealth's duty under the statute. In Smith v. Commonwealth, which admittedly was decided under the previous iteration of this code section, there was an individual who got drunk, crashed his car into a garage door, and then he gets out of his car, stumbles around for a little bit around the property, gets back in his car, drives away. The testimony at trial was essentially that, and that the officer, when he arrived on scene, he looked around, he didn't find any evidence that a note had been left, and that was it. The person who owned the property never showed up to testify one way or the other, whether they received the reported information or whether they had ever found a note. At trial, Mr. Smith was found guilty, and the court reasoned in that case that because there was no evidence as to whether the report of the information was made, that the burden had shifted to the appellant, or to the defendant at that point, to prove that he had made the report. This court reversed and said, no, the Commonwealth has the affirmative duty to prove that the report was not made. The defendant has no burden whatsoever to prove that he reported his information to the parties. The Commonwealth has the burden of proving that the report was not made. The Court of Appeals below essentially took the reasoning that the trial court had taken in Smith v. Commonwealth, which is that this essentially comes to an affirmative defense that has to be put on by the defendant. But this is not the case. It is an element of the offense that the Commonwealth has to prove. The logical conclusion of adopting the Court of Appeals reasoning would roughly be that the Commonwealth has to prove an element beyond a reasonable doubt, and if there's no evidence whatsoever regarding that element, they've proven it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a complete abrogation of their duty under the statute. There are a couple points of clarification that I wanted to make because they were raised in the brief. To the extent that these arguments were made, they are now withdrawn. We are not alleging that Mr. or Ms. Pegram had Mr. Butcher's information already at the time that the accident happened, and thus that the statutory mandate is met. We are not alleging that. The case law does not support that. We are also not alleging that Ms. Pegram was given Mr. Butcher's information at the scene. The argument that we are making, our sole argument, is that the Commonwealth has not produced evidence that establishes beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Butcher did not report his information to the parties listed in the statute.
So what's your view today is whether or not the law enforcement and the victim or the driver is a conjunctive or a disjunctive duty?
That it is a disjunctive duty, Your Honor.
Was that your position in the lower court?
It was our position in the lower court, Your Honor. Well, I'm saying it was not our position in the Court of Appeals at the time, and the Court of Appeals mentioned this in their opinion. At the time, everyone was still under the impression that Banks was still good law, and then the Court of Appeals essentially said no. Given the change in the statute, Banks is no longer good law on that point, and said that the essentially appellant and the appellee were incorrect on that issue. So at this point, we're taking the position that it is in the disjunctive, which is supported by the amendment of the statute.
May I ask you this?
Yes, Ron.
Language of the statute does include a fallback that when, because of injuries, the driver can't do what he's supposed to do. And then it says, when the driver can't do what he's supposed to do, some of the words, because of injuries, quote, the driver shall, as soon as reasonably possible, make the required report to the state police or local law enforcement and make a reasonable effort to locate the person struck or the driver, or some other occupant that the vehicle collided with, or the custodian, ... to provide the information. Isn't that enough to say, well, of course then, on the primary duty, which is being substituted with a secondary duty, they must have meant and there too, just like the original language amplified.
So, Your Honor, the Attorney General brought up something similar with the comparable statute of damage to unattended property. It seems that the reason, or at least appellant's argument, is that the reason for there to be that difference is because of the fact that the purpose of the code is to ensure that the information gets to the necessary parties. So, for instance, if I get into a car accident with someone and I am able, because I'm not injured, that person's not injured, I can just give them my information at the scene. I am required forthwith to do so, and I can do that in a matter of seconds. The police arrive, they'll get the information as well. If for some reason I am injured, there is no reason to think that I would have any ability to give my information to the driver or to the police. Because of that, there's a much higher probability that the information will not get there. So if I am
unable, you've got to give it to both. If you're injured, you got to give it to both. But if you're not injured, you don't have to give it to both.
I think that the reason for the statute to be written that way is that the duty to make sure that the information is reported is covered under the first. So if I am able to give my information, I have a duty to do so forthwith, meaning that my required duty to report it to one party will ensure that it is reported.
So in theory, I could run into somebody under the statute, create the necessary duties because of the amount of damage, and the victim says, well, what's your name? I go, I'm not telling you anything. I'll call the cops on my own free time when I walk away from there. No, what's your name? Tell me, give me your insurance card. Give me your phone number. I'm not telling you anything. I could do that as long as I walk away, pick up my cell phone, and whisper to the 911 operator who I am and what just happened. Is that what the statute is meant to do?
Well, the dual purposes of the statute that were brought up in the briefs, Your Honor, are to facilitate accident investigation and to protect the victims. But if you actually do, as you're walking away, refuse to give your information to the victim, but as you're walking away, you call the police and report your information to them as you're required to forthwith, then the victim would still be protected. The victim could still call the police, say, what's the information that he gave you? The victim's protected. The police still get to facilitate accident investigation.
Well, suppose the defendant lies and walks away and he doesn't call 911 and he's gone.
Well, he's required to stop as close to the scene as possible and report his information forthwith, either to the individual injured or to the police, and the police are supposed to be dispatched to the accident scene anyway.
I just don't understand why the natural reading would not be, since if you have a problem, you can't do it right on the spot, you got to give it to both. But if you don't have a problem, and right on the spot, you could give it to both, you don't have to. I just don't understand why that would be the reasonable way to interpret this.
Your Honor, we only move beyond the four corners of the statute under the rules of statutory construction.
That's just what I've done.
Yes, Your Honor.
Looking at the same statute you're looking at, and if the driver's prevented from complying because he's injured, he's got to give it to both. Okay. Doesn't that imply that you had to give it to both initially?
Well, I think what it also implies, Your Honor, is that for some reason, the legislature, in writing the first part of the code section, did not put the and in, and then in writing the second part of the code section, they did put the and in. If they had the same intent, it seems that they would have used the same language. Further, the language that you're referring to actually was in that code section prior to the legislature amending the code, at which point they specifically removed the conjunctive language from the code. It used to say you had to report to the police, quote, and in addition to the injured party, end quote. However, they specifically removed that language from the code. Now, if Your Honor is correct in that they intended for that to be exactly what it meant and that they intended for that to be consistent with the other code section, then there would be absolutely no reason for them to remove that language from the code.
Did you have an opportunity to look at any of the legislative reports to find out if when they took out the and, comma, in addition, comma, they meant to substantively change the statute from a clear conjunctive to now a mere disjunctive, and yet leave the conjunctive in the injured can't do it right on the spot provision?
I do not have anything to provide the court regarding the reports on why that amendment was made and why the other part of the code section was left as it is. I don't have any information there.
The the issue of conjunctive or disjunctive is important.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the Commonwealth's position is that under either standard, the evidence was sufficient to sustain the verdict, and the Court of Appeals affirming it. What do you say?
So, Your Honor, the appellant's contention is that there is virtually no evidence regarding whether or not the report in question was made, and it's the Commonwealth's burden to prove that the report was not made. So, for instance, if whether it was disjunctive or conjunctive, just going down the parties that are listed in the statute, the state police, there is no testimony or evidence whatsoever regarding whether or not they were notified. The local police, that officer was only asked whether he had personally received a phone call from Mr. Butcher. He was never even asked whether he'd actually been provided the information in the statute or whether or not the police department had ever received the information from Mr. Butcher. He was only asked if he'd personally received a call, and he was asked if he found a note at the scene. But neither one of those actually determines whether or not the Commonwealth's evidentiary burden was met. It's quite possible that Mr. Butcher called the police department, reported his information, and that information was given to Officer Compare. But Officer Compare was never even asked that question. In terms of the other individuals who were at the scene, Ms. Pegram, she was never asked whether she was subsequently provided the information.
But on that, the Court of Appeals said, look, you know, it's not a lot. It's a sensible enough inference when he's stalking her at her house, high-speed chase, he forces her off the road, almost into a tree, she's desperate to get away, he's pounding on the window, that what he was saying when he was pounding was conveying his information about, you know. So at least as to her, that seems like a sensible enough resolution to say, look, maybe he was doing that, but that's not a required inference, and it was sensible enough for the fact finder to conclude on that. But that still leaves you with the local police and the state police.
Well, I think it also leaves us with Mr. Pegram. So Mr. Pegram on the stand was only asked certain questions by the Commonwealth's attorney. He was never asked whether he received from Mr. Butcher the information as required under the statute.
Because he was the custodian of the
He was the one who actually owned the
vehicle, right.
Yes. Okay. So he was not asked whether he'd received that information from Mr. Butcher. The question was simply left open. And then on redirect, once again, the Commonwealth did not ask whether he'd actually received the information. In fact, Mr. Pegram testified that he had spoken with Mr. Butcher multiple times after the accident. He wasn't actually asked at what times these conversations took place, and he wasn't asked what the content of those conversations was. Basically, what we're left with is that three of the four parties listed under the statute, which would meet it either disjunctively or conjunctively, three of the four parties under the statute were never asked whether they received the information from Mr. Butcher, and now we're supposed to assume that the evidence is sufficient, even though it is the Commonwealth's affirmative duty to prove that a report did not take place, which they clearly did not do with three of the four parties.
Could they burden have been satisfied by them asking the local officer, are you aware of any report having been made to the state police? Would that have gotten the Commonwealth to where it needed to be?
No, Your Honor, because of the fact that there's no reason for him to actually be privy to that information. We do believe that if the state police had, as they do in other cases, simply sent in an affidavit that says, we did a records check to determine whether a report was filed with regard to this case. After doing a thorough records check, the report was never filed, given that prima facie.
Possibly if the officer testifies, we have this history of cooperation, we're automatically, well, these that would raise an inference.
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe you guys argue, well, sometimes there's miscommunication, people forget, and then the fact finder would decide, but...
Absolutely, Your Honor. That could certainly raise an inference. But in terms of the facts of this case, the state police never even came up. And the local police officer, he wasn't even asked whether a report had ever been filed with his own precinct. All he said is, I didn't get a call. How does that prove that the police were never given?
Time, and you're well below what you requested. But you may handle your time any way you'd like.
I will reserve my time for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. Whichever way this Court interprets Section 46.2894, the evidence at trial was sufficient to support Butcher's conviction. But there's a published opinion from the Court of Appeals in the Reporters, and the analysis of the Court of Appeals is incorrect. And that is why it is important for this Court to enter its opinion affirming the conviction, but correcting the mistake that the Court of Appeals has made. And while the text of the statute is supreme, as counsel has argued in their briefs, a construction of a statute that permits one who's involved in a serious accident to select either law enforcement or the victim of the collision is unworkable and is an absurd result. For example, under the Court of Appeals interpretation, one who is involved in a traffic fatality could simply go up to the car where the driver is dead and give the information to another occupant of the car and never make a police report and never report to the police. So the police would have no report at all for a motor vehicle fatality.
Well, and you think that's true? I mean, if there's a fatality, don't you think the police are going to report to the scene?
What?
And don't you think the occupant of the vehicle would say, oh, yeah, I've got the guy who hit us was, here's his information right here.
But Your Honor, to say that someone involved in that kind of accident has only a duty to select someone from the list and report only to someone who may be, you know, in shock, who's an occupant of the other vehicle. That's an absurd result. And I understand this court's definition of absurd result is that it is internally inconsistent, which I believe we have seen already today that this is, and is otherwise not operational. And so the general canon of
so
statutory...
Flesh out that last hypothetical. It's 3 a.m., you knock a person into the ditch, the driver's dead, but you knocked into the ditch, the other person's injured, but you give them at 3 a.m., you give them your insurance card and all your information, and you drive off. And they don't have a phone.
That's right. And under the Court of Appeals interpretation, you've done all you have to do under that statute.
5 hours laying in that ditch, and nobody's reporting to the scene of the accident.
Yes, sir. And the other situation is where you undoubtedly have the additional duty to render aid to someone who has been hurt. You could actually have to bring that person to receive medical assistance and yet never tell them who you are, what your driver's license number is, what your car registration is. And so the reasonable reading of this statute is that there is a choice, but the only choice the driver has is whether he is able to give the information to the driver of the other vehicle or whether that person is not able to understand or appears to not understand, and thus the driver has the choice to give his information to someone else. But that's for the second duty. There's a duty to notify law enforcement.
But you understand the plain language point, though, right? I mean, that it seems to read naturally as a disjunctive statute, and throwing, in addition to that, there was a change. So it wasn't originally like that, and the law is, the legislature changes a statute, we presume, subject to explanation otherwise, that that was a substantive change. So those are the two pretty strong, powerful points. And the trump card, as I understand the argument as well, that leads to absurd results, and it shouldn't be read in that counterintuitive, counterproductive way. Is that right?
Your Honor, it's true. And that is the conundrum when we have these two competing tenets of statutory construction. But I will point this out. Originally, 46.1176, which was changed in 1989, was this very extensive statute. It went on for forever and ever. In fact, what is now 46.2895 through about 899 was all in this one statute. And so the phrase and in addition was removed, but also there was this tremendous streamlining of that statute, and much of it ended up being placed in other statutes. And so, and there wasn't an or placed in as a placeholder where it once said and in addition.
Counsel.
There's nothing there now.
Justice McCullough is correct about the rubric that if the legislature makes a change, it's presumed to be substantive. There's only one occasion that I'm aware of when it is actually the presumption is the opposite, and that is with a recodification. Because typically recodifications are intended to make no substantive changes. So my first question is, the significant change you were just speaking of, was that in fact part of the 1989 recodification?
Your Honor, yes, it is, because I have the 1989 replacement volume here, and 46.2894 appears for the first time here, and it is the shortened version that essentially we have today. And the 1985 supplement was the last time I saw 46.1176, and that time it was the lengthy one.
The second question then is this. As we all well know, there's virtually no legislative history for what the General Assembly does. Again, there's there are few exceptions, and one of those exceptions is the report of the Code Commission on the recodification. By chance, did you or someone in your office search for that report on the recodification?
Your Honor, I did not.
Okay.
I do not know what that says.
And I
would like to point out a couple of other cases I think that may be helpful in just looking at this statute in general. And obviously, it's a penal statute, so it's construed strictly against the Commonwealth. But in a couple of occasions, the statute has come before the appellate courts. For instance, and it's cited in the brief in this case, in Smith in 8 Virginia App, which undoubtedly does address 461176. But the argument was made, well, I wasn't involved in an accident because I didn't have a collision. And look at the statute. The statute says I have a duty to inform someone who was in the vehicle collided with. And people fell off of my truck, so I wasn't in an accident. And the Court of Appeals said, no, we're not going to define words in that regard. Yes, you were involved in an accident. And then this court in Malazzo in 276 Virginia had a defendant come before it and say, I wasn't involved in an accident. I actually intentionally ran into that police car. And this court said, you know, it doesn't matter to the person who's been involved in the collision what your intention was. We're not going to define those words that narrowly. And so I think that supports the point that we have, that it is the intent of the legislature to impose these duties on drivers. And in fact, if we look at 462.895 through 899, the legislature imposes duties on even people who are not driving. Those who were in a car when a serious accident occurs and the driver doesn't stop and make the report, those people have a duty. There is a duty when there is unattended property. There is a duty if you are riding with someone who strikes unattended property. There is a requirement in 462.899 that this statute applies whether you're on public property or private property.
So then, under this reading, you have to notify law enforcement, whether it's local or state police, and the driver or passenger, depending on what's going on with the injuries.
Yes, yes. There's a dual responsibility because the purpose is for a defendant not to be able to evade criminal and civil liability and also to assist in the investigation.
Let's assume that your interpretation is correct. Where is the evidence that he did not notify law enforcement?
The evidence that he did not notify law enforcement has to come from Officer Compare. This was a case that was investigated by the local police, and Officer Compare did testify, and initially on page 50 of the appendix, he's asked, and did you ever talk to Mr. Butcher about this situation? And his response is never. And but on page 52 of the appendix, there's some additional testimony from Officer Compare. And I'm looking at, starting about line 9, did you get a call about an accident from the defendant? And his response is, not at all. Okay, and how about leaving information of name, insurance, that kind of thing? Line 14, I did not have that information at that time. So Officer Compare, who is the investigating officer who works at the local police department, does not have this information. And it is a reasonable inference that the officer who is handling the case would have that information. And again, the local police were the ones who were investigating this crime. And it's
where
not
is the lack of evidence that he notified state police? And if he notified dispatch or someone at the local sheriff's department's office and it hasn't gotten to Compare.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the reasonable inference is that that information does get there. And of course, that's the kind of information that would be, frankly, would be exculpatory to the defense when the charge is that you haven't abided by or you haven't complied with this statute, that this is the kind of information that the police would have. And I think that was the Court of Appeals' reasoning in this portion of the opinion, which we feel was correct, is that the reasonable inferences support that no report was made at all. And of course, the defendant today has said that they weren't alleging that he had given the information to the driver, Ms. Pegram. He also did not give that information to the custodian of the car, which is her father. It was her father's car. And I note back to page 40 of the appendix with regard to that issue, because at that point, there was a question to Mr. Pegram as well. Apparently, the defendant called and he said, I'd be willing to pay for half of the damage. And the father said, well, that's great, but what about the other half? But there's a follow-up question, line 19. And did he say anything about your daughter's driving or anything that happened earlier that night? No, sir, he did not. And I think that covers the question. I know that the contention from the defense is that Mr. Pegram was not asked, did he give you his license information, registration, etc. But there's a broader answer here that he hadn't said anything about what happened that night. He just wanted to talk about how to take care of the damage, and then apparently wanted to talk about the relationship between the daughter and the defendant. So I think the Court of Appeals correctly determined that the evidence that was presented on the issue of notification, the reasonable inferences from the evidence that was presented, satisfied the burden the Commonwealth had to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that this statute was not complied with, and particularly and this very contentious relationship between the driver and the victim in this case.
As well as anyone that the doctrine of absurdity, when used in the manner that I think you're trying to use it, requires that on its face, it doesn't work. It cannot work. It does not work. It's internally inconsistent, whatever. I must tell you, I don't see that this is absurd in that sense. I think it's ridiculous. It's what it is. So it does not accomplish what everybody who's talking about this here today thinks it would be the right way to get the information out. Can you help me? Is this the absurd? Is that being used by you in a legal technical sense, or is this nice colloquialism?
No, Your Honor, I tried very much to focus in on incapable of operation or internally inconsistent. And I think it is internally inconsistent given the earlier part of our discussion. If you look at the later part, if you're injured, you have a duty to do two things, but if you're not injured, you only have a duty to do one thing.
Can you do that? Can you do it that way?
I mean, is it possible?
Yeah.
It is possible.
See, that's my point.
Understood.
So it's possible to do it. If it's impossible to do it, it may very well be absurd. But it's possible to do it, but it's ridiculous, is what I hear your argument being, and I suspect I agree. But I just have to have a peg to put my hat on.
And I would look at the other prong of absurd result, which is the internally inconsistent, because I think it's internally inconsistent.
But I guess the problem that it seems like to me you have with that argument is, why wouldn't it be that the other section should say or instead of and? Why do you assume that the or is wrong and the and is correct?
Your Honor, the reason I make that assumption is given all of the other statutes that follow and all of the responsibilities and the goal of the legislature through the ages to have responsibility for those who are involved in these types of mishaps and accidents. And so that is why that is the reasonable conclusion that it's the and rather than the or.
But what about the and is express in the second half of the statute, and the or is not expressed, it's implied. So the express overrules the implied.
Definitely. There definitely is an implicit and between...
There's an explicit and in the second half, and there's an implicit or in the first half.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. That is... certainly there is explicit and implicit within the statute. And we would ask this court to affirm the judgment below.
All right. Rebuttal 123.
Yes, Your Honor. So I'm going to focus on the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence. So turning first to Officer Compare, she's opposing counsel is correct that Officer Compare did testify. He didn't receive a call from Mr. Butcher. Agreed. The only other evidence that was presented was when he was asked specifically, did you find a note or something of that nature at the scene? He said, I didn't have that information at that time. This does not amount to it. I was not provided the defendant's name, driver's license number, etc., as required by the statute. He said, I didn't find a note. In terms of then turning to Mr. Pegram, Mr. Pegram was only asked, okay, did he when you were speaking with Mr. Butcher, and he asked certain questions there, but he was never asked specifically, were you ever provided the information required by the code? It simply never came up. And in response to counsel's point, he was asked, do you have anything that you want to say about the that happened earlier on in the night or between about Miss Pegram's driving, and he said no to that. But
you asked, do you know if the Recodification Act or anything related to that, there's any legislative statement that they intentionally made a substantive change when they took out and in addition?
No.
And they intentionally wanted the word or to be implied by that act?
May I respond, Your Honor?
Yes, you may.
I'm not aware of anything in the recodification that says specifically that they intended to make that change or that they did not intend to make that change. So the appellant is simply arguing on the basis of what the explicit language of the statute seems to show. The language previously was strictly conjunctive, and for some reason the legislature in the recodification removed the conjunctive language and left the conjunctive language in another part of the statute. And I agree with Your Honor that this may be lead to, quote, a ridiculous result, but the question is for this court is not whether or not the legislature's intention creates a statute that has ridiculous results. The question is whether or not they have manifestly absurd results. And given that the statute can still function as it is written, the answer is no, meaning that we have to go with the black letter language of the statute, despite how distasteful the result might be based on what we think it should say.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.